For this next story, we start in Kentucky.
I remember, dear, not long ago, you said you'd be my own.
There's nothing more American than this stuff.
What is it?
Jim Beam. It's okay. Just drink it.
Kentucky gave us Bill Monroe and Bluegrass, the Derby, and one more thing.
No, Mother, I have not been drinking. No. No, these two men, they poured a whole bottle of bourbon into me. No, they didn't give me a chaser.
Cary Grant acting drunk on American Kentucky bourbon. Brown, corn-fermented, oak-barreled, all-American whiskey.
Maybe I should have saved those leftover dreams.
Frank Sinatra preferred it, as did this U.S. president.
There can be no peace in the world until the power of Japan is destroyed.
Harry Truman loved his bourbon, which makes all this a tiny bit ironic.
Now you go and let me hear the traveler's lonesome
moan. That one of the legends of Kentucky bourbon, Jim Beam, is turning Japanese.
For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
The Japanese distillery Suntory is buying Jim Beam for more than $13 billion. Will this acquisition mash up, culturally speaking?
I never thought you'd go away, leave me all alone.
Sour mash is kind of the idea with bourbon, right? We turn now to Charles Cowdery. He's the author of Bourbon, Straight, the Uncut and Unfiltered Story of American Whiskey. Welcome, Charles.
Good to be here.
Well, let's talk first of all about the so-called global boom in whiskey spirits. That's been around for a while. It's really taken off over the last decade or so.
Well, it's been a couple of phases. It really started to pick up steam in the, at least a little bit, in the very late 80s, early 90s internationally. Then in the United States, really started to pick up right around year 2000. And then in the last 3 years or so, it's gone into another gear altogether. And this has really been, I think, the thing that has surprised people, is that it's gone into a sort of a stratosphere that nobody would have predicted.
And there's nothing more – I've said this. There's nothing more American than bourbon. I mean, it really started out with the Whiskey Rebellion at the very beginning of American history, pushed distillers west – where they couldn't be taxed so easily. They ended up in Kentucky. Pick up the story from there.
Well, that's a bit of a myth, although it's certainly a good outline for what happened as far as the pushing people west. But, yeah, the thing that when you crossed the Appalachians, you came to an area where corn grew much better than rye. And of course, corn was still kind of unfamiliar to the colonists, it being a new world grain. And that was really the thing that happened in Kentucky, was the use of corn as the primary grain. And corn gives you a much sweeter whiskey than rye, which is what they had primarily been using up until that point. And that was really what kind of got bourbon started. When they started shipping that sweet corn whiskey outside of Kentucky to point south, people said, well, you know, they like that. And especially in the French-speaking areas, when you get down into St. Louis and down into New Orleans, they thought it tasted more like cognac.
So it took off immediately in the U.S. What was it, though, that made American bourbon whiskey, sweet whiskey, compete with Scotch, which was a much more established brand in the 20th century than American bourbon?
Well, yeah, let's, you know, jump ahead to Prohibition and the post-Prohibition period. And you had, because you have an aged product, you can't just turn on the spigot. So when Prohibition ended, there was very little American whiskey available that was fully aged. And so you had people drinking whiskey from Canada, drinking whiskey from Scotland. And actually, Americans had been drinking rye whiskey more before Prohibition, too. It was really after Prohibition that bourbon sort of came into its own. And it really was a long time before it really spread outside the United States. The exports really only got going as I said, in that sort of late 80s period when, ironically enough, it was Japan and Japanese consumers who decided that they liked bourbon, and they had been and still are very much a scotch-drinking country. But the younger generation wanted something different, and they turned to bourbon. That was really what kind of launched the current renaissance.
You know, the Asian connection is pretty interesting. Last year, when the president signed a free trade agreement with Korea, one of the top items on the list was to remove a Korean tariff on American bourbon. That's how strong the demand is for bourbon in Korea and how much money the government was making off of it from an excise tax. So what do you think it does to the Jim Beam brand to be acquired by Suntory?
Bourbon has to be made in the United States. So and most of it, of course, is made in Kentucky. So it's not going to change where it's manufactured. It's not going to change how it's manufactured. All those things are controlled by U.S. law. So it's really all to the good in the sense of if more of it can be sold in these other countries, that's what's going to keep the industry robust. And it's always going to be an American industry, regardless of who technically owns this or that company.
Your favorite cocktail, Charles?
Well, I mean, my favorite cocktail is just bourbon in a glass, but probably my second favorite cocktail would be Manhattan, and I like Manhattans because you can make them a million different ways. You never have to make them the same way twice.
Charles Cowdery is author of Bourbon Straight, the Uncut and Unfiltered American Whiskey. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you.
One bourbon, one scotch, and one bill.
Jim Beam goes to Tokyo. But we've been asking you, what does your favorite cocktail say about you?
My favorite cocktail would probably be a whiskey tonic. It says about my personality that I have a complex flavor with a side of a bubbly personality.
I buy $2.75 pitchers at the bar, not cocktails. It tells you I'm cheap.
Thanks to TJ in Portland and one of our, let's just say, thrifty listeners in Michigan. Jay on Facebook goes for something more exotic, the Hemingway Daiquiri, though he adds, I'm an idiot for liking a drink that requires a consistently difficult-to-get ingredient, maraschino liqueur. Jay likes a challenge.
Hi, I'm Aaron from Boston, and just like my drink of choice whiskey, I come with a kick.
My favorite cocktail is a gin martini with fresh blue cheese stuffed olives. What does that say about me? Well, it says I want to be James Bond, but I'm stuck here in Wisconsin.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Hey, Scott, you could still be a mall security guard up there in Wisconsin. That's Bond-like, and it's a real job. Ron in Miami, what can we get you?
My favorite drink is a dirty martini on the rocks in a 12-ounce glass right by the pool. And it says that I drink too much.
So Charles' gravelly voice retains a hint of whiskey in it, I think it's safe to say, kind of like the breath of Shane McGowan of the Pogues. Don't sit in the front row at their concerts. Hey, Bonnie, pick your poison.
I like my vodka straight up and strong, because that's the kind of girl I am.
My drink is 12-year-old single malt scotch poured straight into a glass. I guess that says I'm old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned Randy from St. Helens, Oregon, goes for a classic American. I drink a good quality bourbon, straight on the rocks, no nonsense, strong, direct, and simple, with plenty of substance. Morristown, New Jersey, my favorite cocktail, a real martini with good gin and dry vermouth. Says I'm loyal. What does your favorite drink say about you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.